So in the morning, we discussed the statistical ensemble, and I was trying to argue that the density matrix is precisely what you need to describe the statistical ensemble in quantum mechanics, and then in classical limit, this will just become a probability distribution. We define the statistical entropy or von Neumann's entropy, which is simply a trace of rho log rho of this density matrix here, and then in statistical physics, what will stand here is the KB, the Boltzmann constant, but I'm setting that equal to 1. We also discussed that we can actually have our macroscopic state subject to some constraints. And so, for example, we may impose that the expectation value of certain observables are actually fixed to be AI. The trace of rho is always equal to 1. And what this corresponds to is precisely the choice of the ensemble you are considering. So more constraints I impose here. Well, different constraints imposing here means choosing different ensembles, basically. So we can have microcanonical ensemble where no constraints are imposed. We can have a canonical one where the only constraint will be that we have an expectation value for the energy, and we can impose more. But anyway, so then there is this beautiful principle of maximal mass telling you that in the equilibrium, you basically want to extremize the entropy, but subject to these constraints. And we have seen that the corresponding density matrix is simply given by the exponential over the Lagrange multipliers times the corresponding observables divided by the partition function, which is just a trace over that. And specific example of all these is simply the canonical ensemble where I take the only AI to be the Hamiltonian and call lambda to be beta. And in that case, this is your density matrix. That's your partition function. And if you want to connect this to thermodynamics as you know it, you actually find that the Lagrange multiplier beta is just given 1 over the temperature of the system. You can also define the free energy. And what you find is that this free energy is nothing else than the Legendre transformation of the internal energy. And so that's the free energy as you know it in thermodynamics. Of course, you can go to other ensembles, and so you don't really need to do that for most of the cases. But one ensemble which is also used quite often is the grand canonical one. Canonical one. Where you not only allow the energy to fluctuate, but you also allow the number of particles to fluctuate. And so then you have two prescriptions. You have that U is the average value of H, but then you also have that N is the average value of the operator N, the operator of number of particles. And then you would have simply two terms in the exponential, and so your partition function of the grand canonical ensemble would now have trace of minus trace of e to minus beta h, but also there will be this corresponding operator n, so it's plus beta mu n. So again, this would be some Lagrange multiplier which you find comparing to thermodynamics, that it has to be beta mu, where mu is the chemical potential. Okay, so this will be the chemical potential. And depending on how I decide in the next 2 hours, you will either play with this grand canonical partition function tomorrow or not. So let's see. Okay, but anyway, so that's another example of a useful ensemble, and it's quite useful when you discuss quantum gases, when you discuss Fermi or whatever distribution or Einstein distribution. So this would be the ensemble to consider. All right. So now let's demonstrate how this machinery works on the simplest possible example. Let's demonstrate how it works on an ideal gas. Okay, and so for the ideal gas, I'll be using the canonical ensemble, But of course, I can also do it classically. So instead of finding rho, the density matrix, I'll be finding the probability distribution. Okay? So basically going using the dictionary, which I showed you last time, let's use it to say something about the ideal gas. And we are also basically using, so once we find what the free energy is, so we will, the statistical machinery is basically find the partition function Z, okay, which is given here. And then once you know the partition function, you calculate the free energy. And once you know the free energy, you can use thermodynamics to actually describe your things. So from thermodynamics, we know, so the statistical machinery is, the statistical physics machinery is to first calculate the partition function, and then from there you find the free energy. And then you treat it as a thermodynamic potential as you know it from thermodynamics. So the free energy is a function of temperature, volume, and the number of particles if you want. And so it satisfies the following differential equation. Well, differential of F is given by this. It's minus SDT minus PdV plus mu dN. Well, so if you are changing the number of particles, there's the corresponding chemical potential here. And of course, what it means is that I can read off what the entropy of my gas is, what my pressure of the gas is, what my chemical potential is, just looking at this. So for example, the entropy is just minus dF over dT at constant V and N, and pressure is minus dF over dV at constant T and N. And similarly, you can calculate the potential as well. Okay, so this is what we'll be using. Okay, so let's do it. So example, the simple one, and then in your tutorial you will do a more complicated one. Yes?
How do we know the sign for the chemical potential? Like whether it has to be plus or minus, or it doesn't matter?
Well, the question is whether it costs energy to create the particles or not, right? So for example, if you have photons, it doesn't cost any energy to create photons, basically. So mu will be zero there identically. But typically, it costs some energy to create photons. So now the energy is basically the free energy. The only difference between, well, is the TS, which doesn't affect the definition of the potential. So what I'm saying here by choosing plus sign here is that actually it really costs energy to create particles. Okay. So, but of course I can define, you know, mu can be positive or negative. All right. So example will be the ideal gas, and I will treat it, of course, classically. Classical calculation. So what we will be really doing that, let's we assume that we have n non-interacting particles, and so our Hamiltonian is simply sum over I from 1 to n bi square divided by 2m, and then each of, so I enumerates which particle I'm considering, and then these PIs are vectors. They will be three-dimensional vectors, let's say. All right, so that's our Hamiltonian. It's non-interacting particles. Non-interacting particles. And I will assume that they are in some volume V. Okay? So the first step is to calculate the partition function. So the partition function is the trace over e to minus beta h, but the trace just becomes an integral over the phase space if you are at the classical limit. Okay, so that. So now there was some number, which was this 1 over n factorial and 1 over 2 pi h bar to some power. So that will not be important. So there's some number here. Okay, and then you have just the integral over dr1, dr2, drn. And then you have the integral over dp1, dpn of e to minus beta h, where h is this thing here. All right. So nothing here depends on the position r1, r2, rn. Okay. So h is just a function of the momenta. So when I do the integrals over the momenta, that's the problem which I have to solve here. But nothing depends on the volume. So simply, the integrals over the r1, the r2, and so on, they give you the volume. And so each of them gives you the volume. And so if you have n particles, it gives you volume to power n. Okay, so this is some number times volume to power n. And then we have the integrals. And so the integral, let's say the first integral is dp1. And then we have e to minus beta, and then e1 square over 2m. And then we have a similar integral over p2, and so on. So there is n of those. Okay, so now you can calculate it in any coordinates you want. So of course, the simplest one is the Cartesian coordinate here, where I really have p1x, p1y, and p1z. And this is just px squared p plus py squared plus pz squared. So then it's just one-dimensional Gaussian integral. Okay, and so in this case, so now the Gaussian integral of this thing here is just q pi m over beta and to power 3, because I have three of them. So this is just a Gaussian integral integrating over p, and this is what it gives you, square root of 2 pi m over beta and to power 3. So the result is super simple. It's just 2 pi m over beta to power 3 halves times n, and then v to power n. And there is some number which stands in front of there. Okay. I'm just setting the number equal to 1 at this point. Okay, so that's the partition function for the free gas. Any questions? All right, so why I can throw away the number is that what you are not really interested in the partition function, but rather you are interested in the free energy. No, that's not really. But anyway, the free energy minus t logarithm of z. Okay, so it's minus t times, and now I have to take the logarithm here. And the statement is this is equal to minus 3 halves n t logarithm of 2 pi m t minus n t logarithm of the volume. Could it be right? 3 halves n t. Right, logarithm of 2 pi m t. So I'm just using the beta is 1 over t, and then minus n t comes from this term here. Okay. is it right? Hopefully. So that's the free energy. So now if I want to find the pressure, it's just minus dF over dT at constant volume and N. So all I have to do is just differentiate with respect to T. Okay, so now if I differentiate with respect to T here, it just gives me the logarithm. Pi mt, something is strange here. So if I differentiate the logarithm, it kills the t dependence, that's fine. If I differentiate the first term, why does it give me a logarithm?
It's the entropy.
The pressure should be partial.
Sorry? Right. Thank you. I'm differentiating with respect to V. Thank you so much. That's why. So we differentiate with respect to V at T and N constant. Oh, very good. So now we just differentiate with respect to V, and then gives us T N over V. Thank you so much. That's much better. So we have just recovered the ideal gas equation, right? So we have P V. P V equals to T, where V is just V over M. That's the ideal gas law. Much better. All right. So that's the pressure. And so this is the corresponding equation of state telling you that there is a relation between the temperature, pressure, and the volume of the gas. That's the equation of state. All right. So now the entropy is the other one. The entropy is minus dF over dT at constant V and N. Okay, so now this has a logarithm, and it comes about to be 3/2 n logarithm 2 pi mt, and then plus n logarithm of V, and then plus 3/2 n. Okay, so that's what it is. And that's our entropy, quite ugly. But anyway, that's the entropy formula. So now what we can do is that we can use our Legendre transformation formula to calculate the internal energy. So this thing here, so we know what the free energy is, we know what the temperature and entropy are, so we can calculate the internal energy. So U F plus TS, and if you do that, hopefully, so F is this thing here, and now we differentiate it with respect to T, but we are multiplying by T back, so many terms actually will cancel. And so what you will find in the end is that this is beautiful formula, 3/2 NT. So the internal energy satisfies the equipartition theorem. So basically, for every degree of freedom, there is an energy 1/2 T. Okay? This is the equipartition theorem. Another thing, yes?
Are you ignoring the pi and the m in the last
part? Pi and the m.
Because you derivative with the log, right? And you got 1 over 2 of these things, and you still have 1 over 2 pi m.
I differentiate this with respect to t. Mm-hmm. So I'm saying that it's wrong again. 2 pi mt as the first term. Then the second term will be I'm just canceling that, so that should give me something like 3/2.
2π.
Sorry? Is it?
The third term should be divided by 2π.
Yeah. Right,
there
should be 2π in there. Look,
where?
They go out once, and then they...
So this one is that one, and this one...
...derived with respect to t. And then you have 1 over the argument of the logarithm, which also has 2π.
Oh.
So they cancel out.
Thank you for saving me. All right. So anyway, so we have the Euclid partition theorem, which has to work. Another thing which is quite interesting to note is that actually u depends on t, but it does not depend on the volume. So that's a characteristic of an ideal gas. So only ideal gas will actually have this property. And typically, the internal energy will depend on volume. It's like a characteristic of an ideal gas, that the internal energy only depends on the temperature. Okay, and so what it actually means is quite interesting, which people are puzzled about, but it's obvious from the mass. But anyway, so P, if you calculate this P as we did, is that it's minus df over dt. Okay, but now I can use this Legendre transformation for expressing f in terms of internal energy minus ts. Okay, so I just write f, so it's minus d u minus ts, I hope the signs are correct, doesn't matter, dt. What the hell, df over dv, and again, I'm doing the same mistake, sorry, dv. df over dv, that's the pressure, and this is that. All right, so now what is actually quite interesting here, and this is at constant T and N. Okay, so U does not depend on V, so it does not contribute to the pressure. And so the only contribution to the pressure is actually through the dependence of S on the volume. Okay, so this guy does not contribute, and so the pressure comes from entropy, from S, rather than from the internal energy. Okay, so this is completely opposite to what you learn in a high school, where you say, well, the pressure is due to, you know, the particles bumping into my wall or whatever, and so due to the kinetic energy or internal energy of the particles, it's rather due to the entropy, which is quite interesting, at least for the ideal gas. And so people say that the origin of the pressure for the ideal gas is actually entropic. So entropic origin of pressure. So what you are learning in the high school is true, but it's not true for the ideal gas, okay, which you are learning about. So, okay, so it's just interesting. Okay, so finally, what you can do is that you can calculate specific heats. So, for example, if you calculate, so our entropy here is expressed as a function of temperature, volume, and N. Okay, so then you can calculate CV, which is, by definition, delta Q over delta T at constant volume. And so it's T dS over dT at constant volume using the Clausius relation. Okay, we have that. And very good. So I can use this expression for the entropy, and you can calculate the CV. And so all I have to do is just differentiate with respect to pressure again. But the only appearance of the with respect to temperature again, and the only appearance of temperature is here. And it's, so it just comes to be 3/2 n. So this is 3/2 of n. Okay? That's how you calculate a specific heat at constant volume. Similarly, you could calculate specific heat at constant pressure, but to that, you would need to express the temperature, the entropy as a function of pressure instead of volume. So you take this formula here, and instead of volume, you write pressure with the help of the equation of state. Okay. And so if you do it, you get a new formula for the entropy. You differentiate this entropy now with respect to temperature, but at constant pressure. And what you should find, try it, is actually 5/2. So do it yourself if you don't believe that. And so then there's this beautiful Myers law, which people are excited about, which is just a fraction of the specific heat with respect of pressure with respect to the specific heat at constant volume. And well, this better becomes 5/3. This is right. 3 + 1. What I'm doing online is that I'm plugging d equal to 4 here in this formula. So this should be 3/2, and this is 5/2, so that's fine. All right, so that's the Myers law.
And the specific heat, shouldn't that be 3 + nt? Because you multiply.
Yeah, yeah, well, nt, what do you mean? So I differentiate with respect to temperature the entropy, mm-hmm. right? So the entropy.
Then you've got 3/2 n, but then you have to multiply that by t, right?
In the equation?
In the CP.
So I get 1 over t from differentiating the entropy, mm-hmm. and I multiply that by t again. So this is probably fine. Okay.
Okay.
Never differentiate in public. All right, so this is how you do it. Okay, so you just take, macroscopically, you just take the Hamiltonian, you say, I have no interactions whatsoever. It's my basic Hamiltonian. I calculate the partition function. I calculate the free energy. And then I use the thermodynamic relations to derive anything else. Okay, so that was just the free gas. So now, of course, real gas is not free gas. You have interactions between molecules and stuff like that. And so there's a procedure how you can actually include these interactions. So for example, you have to take a microscopic model for your interactions so that that there's some interaction between molecules. There's a nice model which is by these potentials, Lennard and Jones potential. And so then you expand your Hamiltonian to include these interactions, let's say two particle interactions, two molecule interactions, but you cannot solve it exactly. And so people developed a theory, well, they developed an algorithm how we actually solve for the corrections to the ideal gas law due to these interactions of molecules. Okay, so the true gases are interacting. And so then you get corrections to your ideal gas law. Okay. And so then we get corrections to ideal gas law. Okay. But actually, if you are trying to calculate these things, well, as I say, this is an algorithm how to do it. And basically, you can keep correcting these things by including more and more interactions and better and better the interaction. And so in the end, what you have to do is the integral cluster expansion. And you end up with an equation of state, which in principle has infinite number of corrections. Okay, so typically, what you get as an equation of state is that this is your ideal gas law, P is NT, but then this will be the ideal gas law, and then you have corrections, and you keep going as an expansion in N square, well, in N, V3, N3, V4, and so on, and you keep going, just, you know, including more precisely the interactions, where these coefficients of expansion, B2, B3, and B4, are in general functions of temperature, okay? The problem is that even though you may think that going to higher orders actually gives you a better answer, it need not, okay? So need not, so including more corrections, including more terms, need not to give a better answer. Well, let's be nice to people who do that. Okay, it may give you a better answer. All right, but okay, so that would be one type of equation of state which you can write down. These B's in general depend on temperature, and I need to do this expansion. But there's one equation which is super nice, and which was awarded a Nobel Prize, which is the van der Waals equation. Okay, so instead, consider van der Waals equation. So this equation was written down in 1873 by van der Waals, and so he didn't really do these calculations. Instead, well, he might have done something, but instead he like has a very, very physical point of view on things. And so basically what he says, well, the ideal gas law is just PV equals to T. However, if the particles are interacting, the pressure will be increased due to the interaction of the particles. Okay, so the real pressure which should enter this thing here, actually I should add the interaction term to the pressure. And similarly, the real molecules actually are not point-like as treated here, but they are much bigger. So I actually have to subtract the volume of the molecules from there. So in other words, if from PV equals to T, I am going from P to plus A over V square times V minus B equals to T. Okay, so that's the equation which he derived slash postulated. And it depends only on two parameters, and that's what's beautiful about that equation. So A describes, which is positive, describes the interaction of the particles, and B is basically like the volume of particles. So he's saying, well, actually, I have to correct my volume is actually the volume minus the volume of the particles, and then I have to add to my pressure the interaction pressure. Okay, and so this great idea was awarded a Nobel Prize in 1910. So there is a Nobel Prize for that in 1910, and van der Waals was knighted, and so on. So it's really, really beautiful. So why such an interest? Of course, you have only two parameters here, A and B, and so basically you can fit. So if you have given, if you are given a gas, I can fit these parameters A and B by doing some measurements on it. And then the question is, does it describe this gas in all temperature things and whatever? And it does. So for normal gases, this works very well after fitting just two constants, A and B. So this works extremely well for almost all gases, and the price we have to pay is just we measure upon measuring just two parameters A and B. So whereas here, in principle, you have to measure to which order you go, you have to measure some constant. Okay? So this is super nice equation, which actually describes physical gases and real gases upon measuring two parameters A and B. Okay? That's amazing what's about it. Are there any questions?
Yeah.
Yes?
So this equation, is it safe to assume that the constants kind of become are very small at high enough temperatures, because like otherwise all the corrections are bigger terms than the...
Yeah, well, that's the idea of convergence. So you better this converge. And I think it actually mathematically does, but physically not necessarily.
I'm not asking if it converges. What I'm saying is the correction terms actually smaller than the original term?
Yes.
Because
yeah.
To the order n.
I mean, the mathematical convergence of that series is not a problem. What is problem is to really convergence to physical result.
Yeah.
All right. So now you have the equation, which is a super nice equation. And so what people do with the equation is that they typically plot the PV diagram. Okay? So let's plot the isotherms or the PV diagram. So in other words, you are interested in how P looks like as a function of the volume for a given temperature. Okay? So now if you are at sufficiently high temperatures, then the corrections A and B are really small. They don't really contribute. So for high temperatures, you still have some sort of ideal gas law, PV equals to T. So then P goes, okay? So for high temperatures, you would just have this thing here. So this is T sufficiently high. And it's basically like an ideal gas. Okay. However, as you start decreasing the temperature, you suddenly develop an inflection point. So at some temperature, you find an inflection point here, also called a critical point. Critical point. So this is for T equal to T critical. And then for even small temperatures, you find even more bizarre behavior. You find these oscillations. So this is T smaller than T critical. And you find oscillations like this. Okay. So now this is what the van der Waals equation predicts. But of course, this cannot be observed in nature, really, because as you are actually going here in this branch, then the specific heat of that corresponding substance would be negative. And so people don't know what to do with negative specific heat. Okay, but we know that actually that the gases are not really nice and stable at small temperatures. We know that instead, they undergo a phase transition. Okay, so if you cool the gas, it actually forms a liquid. And so it was a discovery. So this is the prediction of the van der Waals equation. And then Maxwell, the same Maxwell who invented Maxwell equations, actually played with this and said, well, actually, I have to replace this unphysical part of the isotherm with something which looks more decent and which actually describes a phase transition. And so what he says is that let's find such a transition pressure, Pt, P phase transition Pt, okay, so that I replace this oscillatory behavior with a line like this. So instead of going down like that, I go here, and then I start changing the phase, I go here, and then I continue on this isotherm as before. And so how do I find at which pressure this happens? Is that so that this area here equals to that area over there. That's the Maxwell's equal area law. So Maxwell's equal area law. So basically what he's saying is that at PT, there's a phase transition. So I go from gas to liquid. And that will happen at such PT so that this area for the van der Waals equation equals to that area over that. Okay, so what does it mean? Is that PT so let's call this V to be the V of the liquid, and let's call this V to be V of the gas. So then I'm saying this area has to be equal to that area. So PT times VG minus V liquid has to be equal to the integral from VL to VG P dV. If I do this integral, I have to have the same as if I do that box integral. And it's precisely capturing the idea that the areas are the same. Or, yes?
I'm kind of lost. How did you get to the area to be the same, the area of those two areas?
I'm just telling you. So I'm not deriving anything. I'm just telling you the secret, how you find what is the transition pressure. Okay, and I'm saying this is given by the Maxwell equal area law. I'm not deriving it at this point. I'm just telling you, you will derive it tomorrow. Okay? But I'm just telling you how to do it. And so this is precisely saying that this area equals to that area can be mathematically captured as that. Okay, so just be happy with this. Or of course, this is completely equivalent to turning that on side. And so I can look at it from this perspective. So I can integrate over P instead of integrating over V, and then I can do a circle integral V dP, and that better be equal to zero. So I'm turning this on side, and I'm integrating like this thing here around, and that better gives me zero. It's exactly the same thing. Okay, so that's Maxwell's ingenious way how to make sense of the van der Waals equation even for these small temperatures, and in fact, how to predict at, you know, the properties of phase transitions. So there will be a phase transition from gas to liquid or the vice versa, and this is the prescription how to do it. Okay, so we have phase transitions, hurrah. Phase transitions. And actually, we can understand them in terms of the van der Waals equation. And so really, you know, going from the van der Waals equation to Maxwell's equal area law and stuff like that, there was a great progress at that time. And that's why the Nobel Prize as well. Okay. Very good. So now, more generally, how would you discover the presence of phase transitions from a thermodynamic point of view? So we will see on Wednesday or later today that we can also understand phase transition from a microscopic point of view. And that's, of course, the fundamental description. But you can already understand them at the thermodynamic level. And how you do that is basically you study the corresponding thermodynamic potential, which is the Gibbs free energy. So transitions. Transitions, and to understand them from a thermodynamic point of view, understand phase transitions from thermodynamic point of view, we look at the corresponding thermodynamic potential, which typically is the Gibbs free energy. We look at the Gibbs free energy. Which is just the thermodynamic potential, which is a function of the temperature and pressure. Okay, so that's our thermodynamic potential, which you have to look at. And so basically what you are interested in is the global minimum of this Gibbs free energy. And the statement is that the behavior of the thermodynamic system in thermodynamic equilibrium is such that it follows the global minimum of the Gibbs free energy. Okay, so if the Gibbs free energy is single valued, well, that's fine. We are single valued, and that's our phase of the matter. However, if you have some crossovers, or if you know intersections of the Gibbs free energy, some non-analyticities in the Gibbs free energy, then you have phase transitions. Okay, so phase transitions, basically, we have to look at the global minimum. Global minimum. Which corresponds to the equilibrium phase, the stable one, corresponds to stable equilibrium phase. And so we have different phases if there are some intersections or something like that. So non-analyticities. If non-analyticities of this global minimum, some intersections of the Gibbs free energy and so on, then we have phase transitions. Okay, so as an example, we can return back to this van der Waals equation. For example, again, the van der Waals fluid. Okay, and so you can plot how the free energy, the Gibbs free energy looks like, let's say as a function of temperature. Of course, this is it's a three-dimensional space. I have G as a function of T and P. So G sweeps a hypersurface in the space T and P. Okay, there will be G here, and there will be P here, and there will be T here. And then we'll have some hypersurface here. If this hypersurface is non-analytic, or if it intersects itself or whatever, then I will have phase transitions. Of course, three-dimensional pictures to draw are quite complicated. Let's do a two-dimensional one. So let's draw G as a function of the temperature for a given pressure. Okay, and so if you do this, maybe I should be drawing as a function of pressure, doesn't matter. Let's do it as a function of temperature. So then, if you do plot this for sufficiently high pressures, what you find is that this is sort of boring. You find something like this for P sufficiently high, so for P bigger than P critical. You just find nice analytic smooth function. There's no double values for this whatsoever. Okay. However, if you are at a critical pressure, you find that you develop a king here at critical pressure. So suddenly, this thing here, so G is still smooth, but its derivative is not. Okay? If you are below the critical pressure, you develop an interesting thing like that. So this is P smaller than PC. Okay? And so now you see that in these regions, you have many values of the Gibbs free energy. And of course, you want to globally minimize this this gives free energy. So in fact, what it means is that here is the global minimum. And instead of going like this, I rather go to the global minimum here. So now you see that the global minimum is continuous, but the derivatives of the global minimum are not continuous here. Okay, so now if you go even further, this thing here just becomes bigger. So now I have something like this for p even smaller than that. So now basically I am plotting three-dimensional picture, how g looks like as a function of p and t, right? So this is for one p, this is for another p, for another p, for another p. Okay, so now you look at that picture from a three-dimensional perspective. So interesting things start happening at this kink here. And then I can sort of connect the points to which it evolves. So I'm connecting this point with that point. Okay. And then you imagine that this thing starts here at this point, and it sort of goes like this and forms an interesting tail. So this is very badly drawn, but anyway. So what actually you created here is a tail. And then at the bottom of the tail, at this point here, there will be a phase transition. Okay? So I don't know how to draw it, but it's a tail. Tail. Well. I'll not try. So it's a tail. Okay? And so this type of phase transition is characterized by this shape of the tail. And because people like animals, they call this shape of the tail a swallow tail. Okay? So it's like if you look at the swallow, it has a nice tail. And so this tail, which I'm drawing here, should remind you that. So this is a characteristic swallow tail. Big swallow tail. And basically it tells you there's a phase transition, certain type of phase transition. All right, so basically, you know, instead of going, you know, this way and that way, which would be like following the natural order, I go here, and at this temperature, I actually undergo a phase transition and go to the global minimum. So following the global minimum, global minimum, 4 gigon minimum at given P, instead of going this like that, I actually go just here and there. Okay, and here at this point, I undergo the phase transition. Okay. So that doesn't mean that you cannot really be if you are studying the physical system, that you cannot be here. It just tells you that I am not at the global minimum of G. So this phase will be unstable. Okay. So this will be like metastable states or whatever. But the global stable states are just the global minimum. Okay. So if you think about, I don't know, overcooled water. You can have water below 0 degrees and it's still water. Let's say at -1 degree because the phase transition did not happen. It would be somewhere here. It would be somewhere here. But if I then shake the system a little bit, it freezes immediately because it jumps from here to there. Okay? So I can have a metastable state. But the stable one is actually frozen. Okay, so that's the phase transitions. So really what you are after is the global minimum of the Gibbs free energy. Very good. So now you can classify the phase transitions according to what happens with this global minimum. I keep losing this. So there's this, is it Enfest classification? Probably. So then there is a classification. Of phase transitions. And so basically, the statement is you'll say that the phase transition is of the first order. If the global minimum is continuous, but the derivative of that is not. So now G prime minimum actually has a jump. Well, that's precisely what we have seen here. So we have some kind of king. The derivatives are, you know, I have one derivative here, another derivative there. So that tells you that the van der Waals fluid phase transition is actually first order. And then it is of second order and higher order, second or higher, if the G min is continuous, and then G derivative min is continuous, but G double prime is actually discontinuous. Okay. So that would be second order. And then you would classify, you know, at which order basically the discontinuity happens. That's your order of the phase transition. So if it's for first derivative of G, it's first order. If it's for second derivative of G, it's second order. If it's for third derivative of G, it's third order, and so on. So this is the discontinuity which you are looking at. And you know, at which derivative it happens, that's the order of the phase transition. Okay, so now the last thing I want to do is to plot the phase diagram. Okay, and so the phase diagram you can plot from looking at the Gibbs free energy diagram. Okay, so the phase diagram. In this case, it will be PT diagram of P and T. And I want to know at which region of the P and T I have one phase, let's say liquid, and in which region of P and T I have gas phase. Okay. And so how you do that is that you look at your GT diagram. So this is your G and T. And so, for example, you see the swallowtail like this. And so then you see that you are liquid here in this global minimum. And then you are gas here in this global minimum. And this is precisely the temperature where the phase transition happens. So this is TPT. And of course, this happens for some given pressure. So I have this diagram for some given pressure. So now if I want to plot the corresponding, what's happening in the phase diagram, is I precisely want to plot this point here in that phase diagram which separates liquid from my gas. So for given pressure, let's say this pressure, I've plotted this thing here. And then I can read the corresponding temperature at the intersection. So that's my TPT, and I get a point here. So that was the TPT, and I get a point here. Then I can do the same thing for a different pressure, and then I have this thing here. Okay? So then for a different pressure, let's say that is a smaller pressure, this one here. And then I look at the value of the temperature where I have the phase transition, and that's my value of the temperature. Well, that will give me another point here. Okay, and so I keep going, and so in the end, what you should find is that actually it fills a curve, and it eventually terminates at the critical point where I no longer have any. So at the critical point, I have this thing here. I no longer, so this is just one point. Above that, for pressure bigger than that, everything is nice and smooth, so there's no phase transition whatsoever. So to the left of this curve, I have the liquid. To the right, I have the gas. And if I cross this line, I actually undergo a phase transition from liquid to gas. Okay, so this is my coexistence line of the two phases. Of the two phases, and as I cross this coexistence line, I change one phase to another. Does it make sense? Who has not seen this? Everybody's seen that. Or everybody, this is trivial. Okay, so perfect. So now notice that, of course, I can start here, and I want to travel here. So I can either go this way, in which case I actually have to undergo the phase transition. Or I can go this way, in which case here I cannot really distinguish liquid from gas. And so this is a perfectly smooth transition where I'm not changing really macroscopic properties of the thing non-continuously. Okay, so basically there is no real distinction between liquid and gas because you can always go around and not really see any phase transition whatsoever because of this existence of this critical point. By the way, you can calculate what this line is without actually doing, you know, this painful thing. I find a point. And you can actually get it from the Clausius-Clapeyron equation, which you will derive tomorrow in your tutorial. So if you want to know how this coexistence line looks like, you have the corresponding equation, which is called Clausius-Clapeyron equation. And let me just write in what it is, and you will derive it tomorrow. So the coexistence line is given by the Clausius-Clapeyron equation. And that's dp over dt at the coexistence is equal to delta S delta V, or is the difference between the entropies divided the difference between the volumes, as gas minus as liquid divided by V gas minus V liquid. Okay, so that's how you find the slope. And you will derive this tomorrow in your tutorial, in case you haven't seen this before. All right, so we have these things here. So by the way, of course, the phase transition which we just described here is because of the jump in first derivatives, this is a first order phase transition. Okay, so this is, I'm changing the derivatives of G minimum, and so G minimum prime. And so that's why this is a first order. But if you go to this, to that tip, basically the origin of the swallowtail, then there will be actually continuous there. So this is a second order phase transition. So the liquid gas phase transition is everywhere on the coexistence line. It is first order. But at that very point, it's actually second order. Okay, so here it's second order. So similarly, you know, writing this Clausius-Clapeyron equation for the first order phase transitions, you can write a similar equation for the second order phase transition. And these are known as Ehrenfest equations. Okay, so Ehrenfest equations are something similar to this. Equation equations, but they are for the second order phase transition. Second order phase transition here. That's the infest equations. All right, and again, you will derive these tomorrow. And basically, what you do is that you'll find that this is zero, that is zero, so you have zero over zero. So you have to take some L'Hopital limit or something like that. So just take a limit of that, and that's what gives you the answer equations for the second order equation. All right, so very good. So now, of course, in real nature, there are many types of phase transitions. So we just discussed liquid and gas phase transition, which immediately follows from the van der Waals equation. But of course, you know that there are solid liquid gas phase transitions. I can actually freeze the water and form a solid. So that's another very typical phase transition. So other phase transitions, roll this one here. So other phase transitions. So the simplest one is solid liquid gas. So this is our phase diagram, P and T. So now you would here have a solid, and then you would have a triple point, and this is a triple point. Where is the coexistence of the three phases? This is our critical point as we know it from liquid and gas. So there is a liquid phase here, and there's a gas phase here. Okay? So that's how the phase diagram looks for solid liquid gas phase transitions. So we already understand this part, liquid and gas, that's our critical point, that's our first order phase transition. But now there is a first order phase transition between solid and liquid as well, and solid and gas, and this is where they can coexist all together. Okay, so now the only difference between liquid and gas, if you take solid and whatever, is that this line sort of keeps going up. So it does not end up at a critical point. And so there is really a distinction between solid and liquid. Whereas there is no distinction really between liquid and gas, I can go around smoothly and nicely. Here I cannot go around. I have to undergo the phase transition. So you here really have to melt the crystal, destroy its structure to form a liquid, okay? So that's the difference. So that's one type of phase transition. Another type of phase transition is the reentrant phase transition. Who knows what a reentrant phase transition is? It is what the name says. It reenters. The same phase reenters again. So if you want a definition, it's like I monotonically change one thermodynamic parameter. I start with one macroscopic phase, okay? And then this macroscopic phase changes to something else, changes to something else, changes to something else, as I monotonically change this parameter. But in the end, I have a phase which is macroscopically similar to the phase I started with. Okay, so changing, so definition is changing monotonically one thermodynamic parameter I end up with the macroscopically same phase as I started with. While in the meantime undergoing several phase transitions. Okay, so now is this beautiful example which really demands that everybody tries it at home. Okay, so the first, maybe not the first one. the first quite well-known example published by in 1904 by Hudson is actually, so what he was doing is that he was playing with nicotine and water, okay? So then you have a phase diagram where here is the temperature and here is the percentage of nicotine. And that's why, you know, everybody can do it. Just start smoking. No, I didn't say that. All right. And so what is actually the phase diagram look like is that, well, we have low percentage of nicotine here, and then, I don't know, 100% here. Well, maybe not 100, but something. And then we have some temperature, and I think it's, here is like 60 degrees, and here is 200 degrees, okay? And so what you observe is a bubble, okay? So you see a bubble here. And so what happens outside of the bubble, okay, it's even better than that. The bubble has actually two parts, okay? So we have an Easter egg here. But anyway, so outside of the bubble, you have a homogeneous phase. So basically, if you are outside, here, so here is the homogeneous phase. So basically, you cannot distinguish nicotine from water. They are in mixed state, which is super homogeneous. If you go inside the bubble, then actually you develop two layers. You have a layer of nicotine and you have a layer of water. Okay? In this upper half is what you would expect is that you have nicotine above water. Okay, so I have a layer of nicotine here, and then below I have a layer of water. If I go through this funny phase transition, they just swap. I have water above and nicotine below. So here you have water, layer above nicotine. And if I cross here, they mix again together. Okay, so for example, you have reentrance because of going this way. I just start with a homogeneous phase. I just keep changing the percentage of this thing. I start with a homogeneous phase, then I actually separate them, and then I end up with a homogeneous phase again. Or this is more interesting, I start with a homogeneous phase. Suddenly, you know, the water wants to be above, the nicotine wants to be below. Then they swap, but in the end, I end up in a homogeneous phase again. So that's an example of a reentrant phase transition. Of course, transitions like this are observed in nature quite often. And it's typically, you know, this reentrance is a consequence of two competing phenomena. Like I have, you know, multi-component liquids and stuff like that. So, you know, which one is winning at that time, that's how the mixture behaves and stuff like that. So this is an example of reentrant phase transition. Okay, so then I had lots of examples from black hole physics, but let's not go there because we don't have time. And instead, I want to actually start a microscopic description of phase transitions. So you can ask me about phase transitions, black hole space times later. Okay, so are there any questions to this? Well, I have to tell you what Ising model is, otherwise you cannot do tomorrow's tutorial. So that's why I have to start the microscopic. So, you know, phase transitions can be fully described using the thermodynamic language, but then you really don't understand what's happening. And you maybe want to learn or predict something more about the phase transition. And to that, you need to know about the microscopics. Okay, so part, I don't know, whatever. So microscopic theory. Microscopic theory of phase transitions. And so let me just repeat what we were doing, but let's just like a story. So the matter organizes itself into phases. And what I mean by different phases is I really mean different macroscopic properties. So these have different macroscopic properties. But what really took a long time for people to understand is that microscopically they are the same thing. We have one Hamiltonian which describes your system, but that one Hamiltonian can describe different phases which have different macroscopic properties. Okay? So for example, in this solid liquid gas, so example would be solid, liquid, and gas. So you would know that the solid, one characteristic property which the solid has, but these two don't have, is the rigidity with respect to shear. Okay, so I cannot really be with respect to shear. Okay, so solid is rigid, liquid and gas are not. On the other hand, if I want to distinguish liquid and gas, I know that the liquid typically has well-defined interface. So liquid has well-defined interface. But gas does not. Okay, that's the simplest example. Another example is ferromagnet. Ferromagnet phase transition. And so if you have ferromagnet that has a non-trivial microscopic magnetization, so that has a magnetization, but paramagnet has not. This M is equal to zero. Similarly, you could do, I don't know, conductor and superconductor. Well, superconductor would have zero resistivity with respect to the current and so on. So they are just, you know, different phases of the same type of matter. And you just distinguish the phases based on the, you know, considering the macroscopic properties of the object. So now the statement is that these macroscopic properties which distinguish various phases are typically result of ordering of something. Okay, so these are the macroscopic properties, for example, the magnetization, are consequence of ordering. And so, for example, if you want to develop non-trivial magnetization in the ferromagnet, then you typically order the spins in your ferromagnet. For example, G-ordering spins in ferromagnet. All right, so that's, everybody happy with this? So phases are really just a different state of matter, but what is really cool is that this is still described by the same microphysics. Only the macrophysics is different, but the microphysics is the same. Okay? So now there will be a canonical example of phase transitions, which, you know, everybody discusses, and you will not be any different. So a canonical example is the Ising model. And Ising model, surprisingly, was not invented by Ising, but was invented by Lenz. Okay, Lenz in 1920. Is it with Z or with C? With S? With Z? That's fine. Okay, so Lenz came up with this model of ferromagnet. It's a model of ferromagnetism. So why the hell is it called Ising? So it's because Ising actually was his graduate student and he found the solution. So there was there's a model which, you know, Lenz formulated, and then Ising found the solution in 1925, and the solution is just one-dimensional Ising model. So 1D, this was solved by Ising in 1925. Okay, so the graduate students solve this problem. You will solve it tomorrow in your tutorial. It's super simple. Okay, but anyway, so he's famous because he solved this problem in 1D. So then it took quite a long time to do it in 2D in Sager. The solution is complicated. It can take the whole course to actually explain what's going on. We'll definitely not do it. But it's super complicated in 2D. Okay, we keep going in 3D. Okay. Do we have a solution in 3D?
No.
Huh?
We don't.
But people are trying. People are trying. So there are some numerical results, of course, and then you know, the latest method is like the bootstrap. So people trying the bootstrap things to actually bootstrap the 3D Ising model. But the solution is actually not there. What about 4D? 5D? 6D? Surprise? Actually, 4D and higher is super simple. It's simple. And why is it simple?
Because mean field theory is exactive.
Exactly. So now there's some nice approximation which we'll discuss next time, which is called mean field theory. It's basically how it treats the fluctuations of the nearby spins. But if you have lots of nearby spins, meaning you are in higher dimensions, then the mean field theory is now exact. And so you can use the approximation to find the exact result for the Ising model. And so actually, this is super simple. So what is really missing is the real world thing, the 3D thing. OK? So now what I mean by Ising model, so this is the story as we go. But it's a model for ferromagnetism. And so basically, you have like a cubic lattice. So now let me just draw a two-dimensional one. Okay. And so in each intersection, I have a spin, and the spin is either up or down. So I have a spin up here, let's say spin down here, spin up here, spin down here, or whatever. So at each intersection, like I have a spin, which is only up or down. And so you can numerate this intersection by some index. So let's call this I. This will be I plus 1, I plus 2, and so on. Okay, so this is just a numeration of where on the lattice I am. So we have cubic lattice. We have spins, which are up or down, which corresponds. So these spins are described by the variables sigma I. So I'm talking about the I spin here. And this will just be plus or minus 1, plus or minus 1. And so the cubic lattice, I'm saying, so the dimension I was talking about here is really the dimension of the lattice. So I can have one dimensional lattice, which is just a line, and I have spin here, spin here, spin here, spin here. Or I can have a two dimensional one, which is this picture here. So that D, so D is the dimension of the lattice. If I have D equal to three dimensions, I'm really in three-dimensional world, and I have a cube. And then I have lots of spins there. Okay, so now what is the theory we are trying to solve? It's given by the Hamiltonian, which is simply given by H is equal to minus 1/2 sum over I and J, Jij, sigma I, sigma J. Okay, so that's the Hamiltonian. So what you are saying is that the spin I interacts with the spin J with the corresponding strength Jij. Okay, and that's the Hamiltonian. And so the minus sign here comes from the fact that the spins want to align. So the minus spins want to align. So in other words, I am describing really a ferromagnet, where eventually, if I want to see non-trivial magnetization, well, I want all the spins aligned in the same direction. Okay, so that's the ferromagnetic phase, which will happen at t equal to zero or something like that. Okay, if I wanted to do anti-ferromagnetic phase, where I always want that one spin looks like this and the other spin looks like that, then you would have a different sign. All right, so this is the model, and tomorrow you will do the Ising's work, and you will solve this model exactly in one dimension. Okay, it took him 5 years. You will do it in 20 minutes. Questions? Okay, see you tomorrow.